So welcome everyone. It's a delight to be back with our Kolel Aharon Veleya series. Tonight, part one of our series on the Book of Ruth, the magical Megillat Rut. We're calling tonight's segment, if you will, Second Chances. And the reason I'm calling it Second Chances is that tonight happens to be coming to an end, a minor holiday. If you went to your favorite grocery store after Passover, there were some severe reductions in the cost of matzah as they are clearing the shelves. And some people like to buy matzah because it's a healthful snack all year round. And also, of course, today was Pesach Sheni, the second Passover. What's that all about? You mean we didn't get enough seders already? What is a second Passover all about? So essentially, it's like this. It's the ultimate second chance. When the Jewish people living in the land of Israel would go to the temple, they would have a chance to partake in a very important mitzvah, a commandment called the Korban Pesach, the Paschal offering, the lamb, the goat. However, what if a Jewish person was either in a distant land or tameh, unclean, and they couldn't bring the sacrifice in a state of what's called ritual impurity, tuma? Or perhaps they were in Europe on a little holiday, but they really wanted the mitzvah because it, more than anything, identifies a person with their Judaism. If you think about it for a moment, it's even something we do today. You will have Jewish people who have no Jewish identity all year round. Maybe even Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, tragically, they are so distant from our people that they're not even going to the temple, to the shul on Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. Yeah, it really is sad, but true. But you know what? Passover comes along. These same Jewish people somehow, somewhere in their genetics or their ancestry, they remember a Passover Seder from their youth. And they want to attend a Passover Seder because it's the way we connect historically with who the Jewish people are. And it makes a lot of sense because the first commandment of the Torah in terms of the Ten Commandments is what? Anochi Hashem Elokecha. I am the Lord your God, Asher Hoseichem Eretz Mitzrayim, who brought you forth from the land of Egypt. That's Passover. If you want to know God, you have to know God through the prism of Passover. So at its essence, it's a very important mitzvah. So Nebuch, these poor Jewish people in the time of the temple, they couldn't partake in this communal joy of having a Passover Seder, a meal, and the matzah, maror, and the lamb, the goat, the offering. And they were very regretful and very upset. And so the rule was enacted that if certain conditions were made, a person 30 days after the original offering, which was the 14th day of Nisan, otherwise known as the Eve, Erev Pesach, today was the 14th day of Iyar. So it's literally 30 days. I guess tonight would be all die, die, yenu. All right, I'm joking. We're not doing that tonight. Don't let your heart be troubled. That's why we have the pita, just to show you. Manishtana Pesach Sheni. Why is Pesach Sheni different from all other days, okay? You were eating chametz a moment ago. I saw you, okay? So it's okay. Don't like everyone's going to get stressed out. Oh, my gosh, Pesach Sheni, I got a third Seder. No, let your heart not be troubled. However, it's all about second chances, that these poor people, with their hearts in the right places, were able to still partake in this communal identifying mitzvah, this commandment of Passover. And hence we have a Pesach Sheni, a second Passover. There are many Jewish people who get together and they have a little bit of matzah, you know, and they have like a little something just to honor Pesach Sheni. So some people buy an extra box of that Shmura matzah and they keep it specifically for today. Some people even eating with us today. And again, it's a beautiful concept. Second chances. So we're going to now see the Book of Esther and some of the events of the Book of Esther, of the Book of Ruth. Sorry, I'm getting back on myself there. In the Book of Ruth, there's a lot about loss, tragedy, death. And there's also a lot about resiliency and rising up in the aftermath of loss and death and tragedy and how we respond. And I believe it's very relevant, sadly, tragically, to our world right now. Shemini Atzeres, the war that began on the October 7th this past year, it's very real. When you go to Israel, it's very real. And we are still in a process of mourning. Even today, many people came over to me and talked about these horrific videos and things that are even being released now for the first time. We're seeing some of the horrors of that day. And you see pictures of these poor shvuyim, the captives. And it's just, it's an unimaginable horror that continues till this very moment. So the book of Ruth has a lot to teach us. So let's just, as an overview, talk about loss. So we meet at the beginning of the book of Ruth, which takes place historically, chronologically, in the time of the judges. So there's a very famous book called the Book of Judges. So the first book of Nevi'im, of the prophets, is called Joshua, Yehoshua. And essentially it deals with the Kivush Ha'aretz, the conquest of the promised land of Canaan, that becomes Israel. And then the Book of Judges, Shoftim, it takes place over a couple of centuries, and it deals with judges. And the book ends with a segue into the book of Samuel, where we're going to meet the first kings. How do I know that it is setting that stage? Because the last words of the book of Judges are, Vayish asher yashar be'inav taseh. Everybody was like, all right, if I like the judge and I want to think that he's a smart guy, I'll follow him. And if I don't agree with his protocols and his rules, I'm not going to follow him. There was no edict that said you must follow the shofet, the judge. So everyone kind of, yeah, I like him, but not so much for this guy. That was a problem. So the book of Judges, embedded in that book, there was a man named Iftsan. And he's not mentioned very much. And Iftsan, according to the rabbis, is the identity of the hero of our story, Boaz. And so this book, Ruth, this four-chapter book, was authored by Shmuel HaNavi, Samuel the prophet. And it is a testament that validates the yichus, the genealogy of the great David HaMelech, King David. And it traces his lineage back from a very unusual, very strange place called Moab, the Moabite lineage. And it's very ignoble beginning, shall we say, for poor King David. But it ends majestically, as we will see in further episodes of the series. So for tonight, let's talk about the book from the sense of loss. It could be, according to some rabbis, that Boaz is not Boaz because of loss in his life. So let's talk about Boaz just for a moment, and then we'll talk about his family, and we get to Ruth, we get to Naomi, and the different protagonists, and there's even a little bit of an antagonist or two showing up. Well, not really, but kind of. So let's talk about who Boaz was. So his name, Boaz, that's the reference of how he's referred to here, means bo, in him, az. There is strength, azut. There's still strength in him. And why would he be called that? His real name was Iftsan, so why not call him by his real name? Because we are told in the Talmud that he lost everybody in his life, buried every member of his family, died, all of them. And when we meet him for the first time, at the end of the first chapter, he's coming back from the last funeral of his life. His wife had just died. And they're mourning because he's Boaz. And who was Iftsan? He was the Shofet Hador, the Gadol Hador. He was the greatest judge and rabbi of the generation of our story. So he is the hero, but he's a hero who has lost everything. And let's now conversely compare and contrast that with the heroine Ruth, and the second heroine, Naomi, who, as we're going to talk about very shortly, lose basically their entire lives. Okay, so let's talk about Naomi. Naomi was this majestic personality. She, along with her husband, who was the richest man in Israel, his name was Elimelech, they lived in a place in Israel in the territory of Yehuda, of Judah. And it was called Beit Lechem, Bethlehem, located in Judah. Very prosperous place. And we are told in the opening verse that there was a famine. a horrific famine in the land of Israel, and specifically in this area where all our players make their lives. Now, her husband, Elimelech, powerful guy. He is potentially, the Parnes Hador, the one who could support everybody, the entire generation. But he is not a happy camper, because every single day, Yom Valayla, days pass, and there are knocks on the door. You talk about having a mishulach or two, someone collecting money. It's relentless. From sunrise to sunset, people are asking him, please help us. Please help us. And eventually, he is not happy. And he takes his wife, Naomi, against her will, ostensibly. He basically just says, we're leaving. I can't tolerate this anymore. And he gets up, and he takes Naomi, his wife, and his two sons, and their names were Mahlon and Kilion, and the four of them leave town. But it's not so simple. They don't just leave town. They don't go to the Red Roof Inn over in, you know, Transjordan area. No. They go to a place called Moab. And Moab is the anti-kindness capital of the world. Literally. It was a place where no one wanted to share. So no one's going to be knocking at Elimelech's door trying to deplete his stock portfolio. Yeah, because Moab, that's not their nature. They don't share. They're a little bit like Sodom and Gomorrah, but they're not sharing. So he comes and he betrays Israel in its profound time of need. Because again, he could have been it. In fact, his name speaks to this. Eli, Eli, from me, Melech will come the king. I will be the father of the kings. I will be ultimately the one who will provide, because that's the essence of what a king does, is lead and provide his flock with what they need. So he really believed, Eli HaMalchut, the kingship will come from me. In a very bitter, ironic way, it's true, but not in the way that Elimelech thought it would become a reality. Okay. So Elimelech takes Naomi against her will. Meaning, when we say against her will, it just meant she didn't have a say in the matter. We're leaving. What are you supposed to do? She's coerced. She didn't want to leave Israel, but her husband's leaving. She's leaving. So she leaves. They take their sons, Mahlon and Kilion. Now, the rabbis make a big point of talking about some of their names. So I mentioned how the name Boaz is really not his name. It's a pen name, right? For sure, the sons are pen names. How do I know this? Because I'm a rabbi and I can tell you what their names mean. You ready? You go to a bris milah on the eighth day after a boy, hopefully he's not jaundiced, and we have a circumcision. We name the little boy, right? I promise you, anywhere in the world history, never has a mom and a dad named a little bouncing baby boy Mahlon or Kilion. Why? Because Mahlon comes from where Machala, disease. And Kilion comes from the word lekale, death, to be destroyed. Imagine at the bris, we want to now proudly name our little bouncy baby boy Death and his sibling Disease. Yeah, that will go well. That will go well. So Mahlon and Kilion are, one is dying ostensibly as a disease, Mahlon, but he's not dead yet, and that's important. And Kilion is dead. He's gone on some level. So what happens? The four of them come to Moab, and how do the Moabites react? Bruchim Abayim. I mean, if they spoke Hebrew, right? Welcome. They love the fact that this guy Elimelech has lots of money, and that why is he leaving and betraying his people? Because he doesn't want to share. They love it, because Moabites don't share. So they say, yeah, you're one of us. Welcome. Kum Tachayin. You know, welcome aboard. It's great. We love you. So they welcomed him with open arms. So he comes with his family. And their original intent is lagur, to dwell temporarily in the fields of Moab. Doesn't quite work out that way. Because then the next pasuk goes on to say, Vayusham. They were there. They became part and parcel of the infrastructure of Moab. And that's where they lived. So much so that Mahlon and Kilion married Moabite young ladies. But again, they weren't just regular, you know, Moabite ladies. They were princesses. Mahlon marries the hero, heroine of our story, Ruth. And Kilion marries Orpah. Orpah. So you have two princesses who convert on some level to become Jewish. Mahlon and Kilion marry them, and they're there. So Hashem is not happy with Elimelech. You can imagine that you just betrayed my people. What do you think I gave you money for, you idiot? I gave you money for a moment like this in a crisis where there's a famine to help my people. And you're running away to Moab? Really? So he starts to give gentle and then not so gentle hints to Elimelech. You made a bad choice. So he starts to lose his money. His stock portfolio crashes. Does he get the hint? No, of course not. Then he gets his health taken away from him. Again, doesn't wake up. And then finally he dies. His sons could have gotten the message, dear old dad made a huge sinful mistake. They don't leave either. And so what happens to the children? They die. Mahlon and Kilion, they're dead. So Naomi's alone. And who does she have? She has her daughter-in-law, Orpah, and her daughter-in-law, Ruth. That's all she has. She has no money. She has no youth. As she sees herself, she's a dried-up old woman with no prospects of anything. She's a widow. She has gornish. So what is she going to do? Go back home? I mean, she wants to, but she's not sure she should. How are they going to welcome her when she's the wife of the one who betrayed the people? So she hears a fantastic message. The famine, the ra'av, has ended. Things are now good in Israel. Things are looking up. So she takes that as a message. She's got to go. It's the middle of Passover, beginning of Passover. You can't travel distances during Passover. And she's determined. She gets up and she goes because she sees herself that this is an existential threat. If I stay here longer, I'll never leave. And so she's determined to come home. So she comes home right on Passover. And her daughter-in-laws, Ruth and Orpah, accompany her on a journey. And it's an interesting journey, the three of them. They have nothing. The rabbis make a point of saying that they don't even really have shoes on their feet. But such was the desperation of poor Naomi, to get home. Doesn't matter. She's coming at any cost. So my Rosh Hashiva, one of my teachers, Rabbi Weinberg, he says he compares it almost to a person who wakes up like in an untenable situation in a cult or wherever it is. And they wake up and they realize like cold water splash on their face and they're like, holy smokes. And what was bearable, maybe even for years, in the flash of insight, becomes unbearable even for one moment longer. I need to save myself. I need to go. And that's Naomi's desperation. So she leaves on this fateful journey, and her daughter-in-laws dutifully accompany her, or so she thinks. So on her way back, she realizes they're coming with her. She turns to the two of them and says, look, I love you both very much. The fact that you are not trying to sue me in Moabite court for dowries and money that would come from my non-existent estate, bless you. God should take care of you. But I have nothing to offer you. I have no prospects. I have no more children. And I have to tell you that if you come back to where I'm going, xenophobia is rampant in Bethlehem, Judah. They're going to hate your guts because they're going to find out, based on your passports, that you are Moabitesses. They're not going to like you on any level. No one's going to talk to you. Don't know the language. No one's going to give you the time of day. And I have nothing to offer you. You have no husband prospects. You're young ladies. You still could have a life. And you have big money because your father, grandfather were the kings of Moab, Eglon. So you have money here in the Moabite banks. Just go home. I don't need you. I have nothing to offer you. So Orpah is like getting that water splashed in her face. So she wakes up and she realizes, what am I doing? This is insane. And she heeds the advice of Naomi and she is totally dissuaded. So she gives a kiss. And you know the expression, just to kiss it off? Probably comes from that moment where she kisses goodbye. And then Orpah comes from the word for your mul oref, the little nape of your neck. She turns her back and leaves. Another day I'll tell you that she becomes the antagonist of the Jewish people historically. But that's another story. So Orpah leaves. But Ruth has not gone anywhere. So Naomi looks around and she sees Orpah's like heading back to Moab. She says, "No, Ruth, please, your fellow daughter-in-law of mine, I love you, but can you follow her, please?" So Ruth looks at her and says, "No." And this is where it gets really beautiful, famous. I would argue the most poetic verses in all of the Torah, where Ruth clings to her, dafka. And it's an existential feeling of, "Naomi, I am immovable. I am intractable. I'm not going anywhere. I'm with you. Only death will make me and you be apart. I'm coming back with you. If you force me away and you say I'm not coming, I'm still coming, with or without you. This is my destiny. I love you, Naomi, and I want you to be the one who brings me to Hashem to understand God and to be part of the Jewish people. But if at the end of the day you refuse me, I'm still coming, whether you like it or not." And Naomi starts to go through all these different things that Jewish people have to keep, all these extra laws that someone who isn't born Jewish doesn't have to keep. And she's trying to, you know, basically convince poor Ruth that it's too much for her. And everything that Ruth says as a response is, "Is that the best you can do? This is not a problem. Oh, I can't do this, I can't do that. I'm in. I don't care about the details. I'm in." Which is exactly, of course, what a Jewish person said at Mount Sinai when God said, "Do you want my Torah?" Remember what we said? Nasa v'nishma. I'm in. Tell me about the details tomorrow. I don't care about the details, Hashem. I want you. I don't worry about the little details are for tomorrow after I become Jewish. This is exactly what the majestic Ruth says to her mother-in-law. So Naomi comes back and Ruth's with her. And it's a majestic time. I mean, they, you know, the verses of, like, I have it right here in your sheet in the first paragraph, right? Where Ruth says, "Entreat me not to leave you or to return for following after you, but for where you go," or in the old English, "where thou goest, I will goest." I don't know who made up the word goest, but it's a good, cool word. "And where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried," Ruth says to Naomi. "May the Lord do so for me and more also, if anything but death part you and me." I mean, just perfect, right? It's beautiful. So they come home. And just as Naomi had said to Ruth, there's nothing for Naomi. She comes back. And there's a bunch of people, and they all see Naomi. Now, why are they a bunch of people? They're not welcoming Naomi back. There wasn't, like, you know, a secret tweet that went up on Facebook, "Naomi, wife of the former dead Elimelech, you know, the Elon Musk of the Jewish people is coming home now. Let's go greet her." No. They were all out there because, as I mentioned earlier, Boaz had just lost his wife, and they all went to Boaz's funeral for his wife. So they're all coming, and Naomi's coming with Ruth. They don't know Ruth, and they're looking at Naomi, and these are Jewish people. And instead of, like, saying, "Oh, Naomi, welcome home. Can we help you? You look like a little bedraggled. You look a little bereft of anything, you know, like maybe no shoes." They mock her. They don't even talk to her. They talk about her in her presence. I mean, what would be more demeaning to the poor woman? So Naomi actually says to them, she says, "Look, don't call me Naomi," which means pleasant, beautiful. That's not my name anymore. "Call me Mara, the bitter one, because God has done a lot of bitterness to my life. I've lost my husband. I've lost my children. I come home empty-handed. I have nothing." Now, what would a normal human being do at this point? What would anybody do?
Grieve.
Like maybe Put out your hand and say, "Naomi, can we help you? You know, can we send you some food for Shabbos? Where are you staying? Like, I have an extra place." No, they just ignore her. They pretend like she's like a wallflower. Nothing, no response. So, I mean, it's really horrible stuff. And that's for Naomi. Ruth, forget about it, right? She's the Moabitess. They're not even acknowledging her very existence. That's a horrific thing. So the rabbis point out something beautiful that has to do with second chances. From the point of view, the perspective of Naomi, she has nothing, Right? She literally says to them, I have nothing. I came back with nothing. Listen to her words. She says, Ani, I, Naomi, Mileya halachti. I left when I was male. I had everything. I was complete. I had money, a husband, children. The world was my kosher oyster. That's how I left town. And now that I'm returned, how am I? So as a counterpoint to the idea of mileya, that I was male, she says, V'rekam heshivani Hashem. God has brought me back reik. I'm empty. I have nothing. Garnished. Nothing. So the rabbis say, Hashem sort of subtly saying, excuse me, look to your right. You have the world. Her name is Ruth. You have Ruth. Don't ever say you have nothing. So it's a powerful idea. Sometimes when we lose something, and it's understandable, in our tears, in our mourning, in our sadness, we struggle to take in the blessings that we still have because we've lost. We lost 1,200 beautiful people who were butchered on October 7th. We've lost 600 or so IDF soldiers on that day and in the subsequent war. And they're each a world unto themselves, unto their moms and dads, unto their world. So in some sense, we all feel like Naomi feels. Rake. We're empty. We have nothing. We've lost. And Hashem says, you haven't lost. Because yes, you've lost. Just as our magical Tova told us in her talk, Tova Friedman. She lost the world. And yet she rebuilt that world. She reclaimed that world for herself. And we will reclaim the world for ourselves. And our book, Naomi and Ruth together, reclaim their, oh boy, do they reclaim their world in the most magical way possible. So yes, it looks really bad right now for poor Naomi, to say the least. But Hashem is saying, sometimes your blessing could be standing right next to you, but we can't see it. We can't take it in. We don't understand the enormity of the gifts we still have. We look at our loss, and you have to look at what you've lost. It's human nature. How could we not? Life can't be the same without that person that we've lost. So in the morning, in the avilut, it's powerful. It's horrible. And yet, there could be a Ruth with us, or more than one Ruth with us, that we still have that hope. And one of the most magical themes, I think, of Ruth, amazing idea, is second chances. Just like with the second Passover, we have second chances. There's a very curious rule, law, and it runs throughout the entire family of King David. I'll explain it to you briefly. It's called Levirate marriage, Yivam. How does it work? Well, today we don't do it. So you'll be happy to know, or unhappy to know, that the rules I'm going to tell you now do not apply in the Ashkenazic world. The Sephardic world, I'm not sure. Okay. In the Ashkenazic world, here is what used to be, okay? Suppose a couple dwell together with their family, husband or wife, and they didn't have a child. And the husband died. So let's call the husband Machlon. Just a word I pulled out of thin air, okay? Machlon is married to, let's call her Ruth. Okay. So Machlon and Ruth are married. And they don't have a child together. And Machlon dies, childless. There is a mitzvah, a profound law, very difficult one to do, that Machlon's younger brother, or let's just pick a name out, Kilyon, it would be incumbent upon Kilyon to marry someone who he's not allowed to marry by Torah law, his sister-in-law. But once his brother dies, there's a special mitzvah called Levirate marriage, Yivam, that if he's able to, if he has the courage and he's has the genetics and is able to have children, obviously all those things are requirements, he should marry. Very easy, because they've already done everything else, so it's basically just him consummating the marriage with his former sister-in-law. So the brother who's living, Kilyon, will marry Ruth. They have that child, and that first child doesn't belong to the brother. It belongs to the dead brother, essentially. It's like a recreation, a Gilgal of his soul, of his neshama. So you're giving life in the most profound way to someone who died. So we don't do this today. But in our story, it happens. Now, it doesn't happen quite the way I laid out for you, because it's usually two brothers dwelling together. It doesn't happen in a conventional way. But in the end of the story, which you know, so I'm not spoiling, I'm sorry, spoiler alert. But if you don't know the end of the story, Boaz marries Ruth through levirate marriage. Boaz is a kinsman of Naomi, and therefore Naomi's dead son, Mahlon, former husband of Ruth. He performs a levirate marriage in absence of a brother, because remember, Kilion is also dead. There aren't any brothers to perform this rite. So Boaz marries Ruth, and they have a child together. And then that child has another child, and eventually King David comes from that union. And eventually King Solomon comes from that union. And eventually the Mashiach, the Messiah, comes from that union. Really good union, okay? And that all comes from this levirate marriage. And this incredibly happens to King David on all sides of his family. Because if you go back far enough, historically in the Torah, you come to Moab. Now, who was Moab? You know, the word Moab is kind of gross. Sorry about this one. Yeah, but you ate, so you won't get grossed out. Moab literally means from father. Who was he? He was the product of an incestuous relationship from Lot, who is the nephew of Abraham, who left Abraham, went to live in Sodom and Gomorrah, was saved by Sodom and Gomorrah's destruction by the angels. He went up to this mountain, and the only people who lived, remember, Mrs. Lot turned to the pillar of salt, so she didn't make it. So it's just Lot and his two daughters. And the two daughters give their father major adult beverages to consume. They get him drunk, and each of them is with their father. One gets birth to Ammon, one gives birth to Moab. Moab, from my father. Now, you might say, Rabbi, that's really gross, and it is. But it's also, if you strip it bare, it's also very noble. Think about it for a moment. It's levirate marriage. You're saying, what? What are you talking about? It's dad. Okay, I understand that. Before the Torah, it's weird. But think about it. What was the reason that the daughter got her dad pregnant and needed to have a child? Because from their perspective, they didn't know that Sodom and Gomorrah was the end of the destruction of the world. They believed the world is gone. Who are the only people left in the world? Dad and the two girls. So when she, the daughter, gets pregnant by dad, she believed that she was carrying on the human race, that humanity would only exist and carry on and procreate if it was with dad. There was nobody else to procreate with. So yes, it's gross, it's disgusting, but she did it in a noble way, even though it's gross. You don't name the kid from dad, thanks a lot, you know? But that is the ancestor of Ruth. So Ruth came to be from an act, again, I have to say it, it was somewhat of a noble act, that the daughter did it. Now, dad may have had lascivious intentions, but the daughter didn't. She had the heebie-jeebies, right? She did it so the human race could carry on. But that's not all, because let's look now. I just gave you the Ruth side, right? What about the dad side? Remember? Ruth comes, her, their child together comes from Boaz. Well, where does Boaz come from? Judah. So I'm not going to go into details. You'll look it up in the Torah, because we don't ever defame Judah over the story. But Judah does levirate marriage with a young lady named Tamar, who had been married to his oldest son, and whose son died without a child. And then the next son died without a child. And they thought that she was a jinx, Tamar. And so he forbid his younger child from marrying Tamar and sort of forced Tamar to go in to do radical intervention. She does radical intervention. Judah becomes the father of that child with Tamar, whose name is Peretz. Peretz is the great-grandfather of Boaz and, of course, King David and the Messiah. So you have, amazingly, right, levirate marriage, mom's side all the way back historically in time of Lot, dad's side, Judah and Tamar, our story here with Ruth and Boaz, all the way down to King David. Now, that means I could give classes on what I just explained to you, okay? Because it's amazing stuff. Like, what's a takeaway? I think the simple takeaway is that it's teaching us the nature of the gift that God gives us for life, that life will win in the end. It may not exactly duplicate the dreams that we have for what that life will be. Sometimes the dreams and visions that we have, we think it's going to work out one way. And God says, no, but it'll work out. So I guess that's the takeaway for today that should give us some solace. We have lost, as the Jewish people, so many. And they can't be replaced. But maybe there would be a way for us to metaphorically perform a Levirate marriage. And I don't mean really marriage or Levirate. But we need to fill the void. In other words, we're still here. We're like Naomi looking over and not understanding that Ruth is magical and she's right next to her. We still have the capabilities with our own lives to transform our lives in a more meaningful way. We have an ability to step up, and in the void, in the absence, the death of a husband, we can step up and we can do something magical to bring life, purpose, meaning to the deaths of those people. And that's my prayer for all of us. I know that in Israel, they take this very, very seriously. Each and every family, you know, has a way they're forward. So they're getting married still in Israel. They're still having children in Israel. You know, people are living life. They're not dancing the same way. In some ways, they're dancing more passionately. You know, when you see a wedding now, to contrast that with the funerals that we've been through in Israel, where they were attended by tens of thousands sometimes, those funerals, tens of thousands of people are also going for people who are getting married because they understand the profundity of life. So what is the response to death? The response to death is a second chance. God gives us ordained a second chance for the woman through Levirate marriage, the Yivam that we see as a thematic element here, but also just taking in what we still have to take account of who we are and what we can do for our future. So my prayer for all of us, for all the Jewish people, we in our, each in our own unique way, has our own mission, unique skill set that we bring. Whatever that is, make it better. Double down on your own skill set and offer that as a form of a future for our people. And I promise you that Megillas Rus, the book of Ruth, comes along to teach us, just like Pesach Sheni does, that if you desire it, if you will it, God created this Passover second opportunity because the people really just, they couldn't live without it. They were determined. If we will refuse to take no and say, we are a nation that is alive, that is living, with a living God, and we value life more than anything else in the world. And if we will ascribe value to ourselves and the people around us, and maybe just wake up one morning, you'll see that you have a Ruth already in your life, and you're like, wow, what could be? So my bracha for you, for me, all of us, for all of Klal Yisrael, is that we should continue with that life and that Naomi Ruth quest for a future. Wish everyone a wonderful evening.